Load up on fibrous veggies. This can slow the absorption of both carbs and fat, giving the liver more time to process a meal. Reduce or eliminate alcohol consumption. A six-pack of beer can cause instantaneous fatty liver in healthy young men in the course of one sitting. Integrate periods of intermittent fasting, which boosts LDL recycling. More on fasting in the next chapter. Integrate higher-carb, low-fat post-workout meals 1 to 2 times per week. Once insulin sensitivity is regained, insulin can be used to turn on the liver's LDL recycling machinery. Sweet potatoes or white or brown rice are good low-fructose options to help kick that process into gear. Once one of these now-toxic LDL particles penetrates the vessel wall, adhesion molecules are released to mark the site of injury. Then, various pro-inflammatory messengers called cytokines are secreted, which alert your immune system to a breach. This promotes the accumulation of immune cells that stick themselves to the site of the action, forming what is called a foam cell. When multiple foam cells coalesce, they create a characteristic fatty streak, marking the beginning of what, over time, might become a plaque as other immune cells, platelets, and dysfunction of the artery wall compounds. The process of LDL oxidation clearly plays a major role in the development of atherosclerosis. Interestingly, atherosclerosis is only found in arteries as opposed to veins. Arteries, unlike veins, carry oxygenated blood in a high-pressure environment, providing fertile ground for those small, dense LDL particles to become damaged and stick to the vessel wall. And while a heart attack due to plaque buildup in the arteries surrounding the heart is what many would consider a worst-case scenario, atherosclerosis can happen anywhere, including the microvasculature supplying oxygen to the brain. This is what vascular dementia is, lots and lots of tiny little strokes in the brain, and it is the second most common form of dementia after Alzheimer's. But what if you're young and healthy, decades away from that brain disease that only old people get? Can this elegant plumbing system really affect your cognitive function? My friend and colleague, Dr. Richard Isaacson, who heads up the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian, has seen countless patients whose elevated levels of small, dense LDL particles have correlated with lower than expected executive function on cognitive tests. This includes the ability to think clearly, focus, and be mentally flexible. While the exact mechanism is unclear, it's plausible that the underlying processes described above are contributing in some way. Dr. Isaacson is now rigorously studying these associations in an effort to validate his clinical observations. Increasing blood flow to the brain. Our brains are massive oxygen consumers. 25% of every breath you take is going directly to support the ravenous metabolic needs of your brain. And ensuring that your blood lipids are healthy is one way of keeping your cognitive power supply free of interruption. Thankfully, there are some other ways of increasing healthy blood flow to the brain. Eat dark chocolate. Compounds in dark chocolate called polyphenols have been shown to boost brain perfusion or blood flow to the brain. As we learned with Genius Food number 4, stick to 80% or higher for the cocoa content, ideally 85% or higher. This means less sugar. And make sure the chocolate has not been processed with alkali, which degrades antioxidant content. Eliminate or reduce grains, sugar, and starch. Allowing your brain to run on fat, or more specifically ketones, may increase blood flow to the brain by as much as 39%. More on this in the next chapter. Consume more potassium. High potassium foods include avocado. A whole avocado has twice the potassium of a banana. Spinach, kale, beet greens, Swiss chard, mushrooms, and believe it or not, salmon. Indulge in nitrate-rich foods. Nitric oxide dilates blood vessels and expands your arteries while also improving blood flow. Gram for gram, arugula has more nitrates than any other vegetable. Close seconds include beets, butterleaf lettuce, spinach, beet greens, broccoli, and Swiss chard. A single nitrate-rich meal may boost cognitive function. Can heart disease begin in the gut? One last and underappreciated means by which the small, dense LDL particles may overexpress in the body is through an unhealthy gut. Within the sanctuary of our intestines resides an impressive population of bacteria. Most of the time, these bacteria are friendly and enhance our lives in invisible ways. But when we neglect to maintain their home turf, bacterial fragments can bleed into our circulation, causing major problems. One of these normal bacterial components is lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, also known as bacterial endotoxin, meaning internal toxin. Under normal circumstances, this endotoxin is kept safely in your intestines, much like the highly corrosive hydrochloric acid that is kept in your stomach. But unlike the stomach, the lower GI tract is a place of active transport of nutrients into circulation. It's quite a selective system, but as a result of our Western diets and lifestyles, the barrier that controls these transactions can become inappropriately porous, allowing LPS to seep through. One way our bodies may provide a means of damage control is by sending LDL cholesterol carriers to the rescue, like firemen tasked with putting out a fire. It's believed that LDL particles serve an antimicrobial purpose, containing docking sites called LPS binding proteins that allow them to soak up renegade LPS. When the liver senses that LPS has entered circulation via inflammation signaling, it ramps up production of LDL to bind and neutralize it. A chronically leaky gut may therefore drive LDL through the roof. On top of that, once the LDL binds with LPS, the endotoxin may affect the liver's ability to dispose of these toxin-carrying particles, creating a double whammy of trouble. A small but increasing number of cardiologists believe heart disease to originate in the gut for this very reason. Here are just some of the ways you can protect your gut to promote healthy LDL levels. Consume lots of fiber. Dark leafy greens like spinach and kale are excellent sources of fiber, along with asparagus, sunchokes, and alliums like garlic, onions, leeks, and shallots. Start slow and work your way up to avoid any digestive discomfort. Double down on raw probiotic-containing foods. Kimchi, sauerkraut, and kombucha, my personal favorite, are great options. Get in lots of polyphenols. These benefit both you and your gut microbes directly. Good sources include extra virgin olive oil, coffee, dark chocolate, and berries. Onions are also great to support gut barrier function. Cut sugar from your diet, especially in the form of added fructose. Fructose, whether from organic table sugar, sucrose is 50% fructose, 50% glucose, agave syrup, 90% fructose, or high fructose corn syrup, which is actually 55% fructose, not only increases intestinal permeability, but facilitates the leakage of LPS into circulation. Low-sugar whole fruits are fine because they come packaged with fiber and nutrients that support the gut's own resistance to permeability. Viva la resistance! Eliminate wheat and processed foods from the diet. Gluten, the protein found in wheat and added to a multiplicity of processed foods, has the potential to expand the pores in the gut lining. This effect may be magnified by low-fiber diets and additives common in processed foods. This topic is explored further in Chapter 7. Doctor's note: HDL, the good, the bad, and the fugly. Before medical school, when a doctor started talking to me about good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, my eyes glazed over. Say what? Now, when a doctor talks to me about good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, my eyes still glaze over, but for a different reason. Because when you go down the rabbit hole, the good-bad analogy becomes laughably simplistic. The previous section focuses on the LDL story because all else equal, more LDL particles floating around for longer means higher disease risk. High-density lipoproteins, or HDL, the good cholesterol, on the other hand, are less well understood, but just like LDL, the total amount of cholesterol in your HDL test may be less important than the number of healthy functional particles you have. HDL particles are thought to benefit your health because they are sort of like the cleanup trucks. They pick up excess cholesterol from the far reaches of your body and deliver it back to your liver, where it is converted to bile and passed. In fact, a low LDL to HDL, or HDL to triglyceride ratio, is a stronger predictor of heart disease risk than high bad cholesterol. Interestingly, saturated fat, while it does raise the amount of LDL in the body, also raises HDL, maintaining a cardiovascular favorable lipoprotein ratio. But the amount of HDL you have isn't the whole story. Newer tests are being developed to look at the functionality of the HDL recycling system. We call it efflux capacity, how efficiently your HDL scavenges cholesterol from the overworked white blood cells in your damaged arterial plaques and shuttles it back to the liver. The other aspects of functional HDL are still being discovered. It acts as a potent antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. It supports vessel health by promoting the creation of nitric oxide, a gas that keeps your blood vessels dynamic and open, and it may even have an anti-clotting component. Okay, so you love HDL as much as we do. Now, how do you make it more functional? You guessed it, a lower-carb diet. Adults with metabolic syndrome, more than 1 in 2 U.S. adults, generally have low HDL, high triglycerides, and elevated blood pressure, blood sugar, and abdominal fat. A lower-carb, high-fiber diet reverses all of these factors and returns you to a state of metabolic health. When you consider that even mildly elevated blood sugar alone increases your heart attack and stroke risk by 15%, this is a no-brainer. One last thing. HDL proteins are probably no less sensitive to the biochemical blowtorch of oxidative stress from rancid polyunsaturated fats and sugar than the LDL proteins are. So you can kill two birds with one stone by reducing your consumption of processed vegetable oils. Statins, the brain drain. One result of the widespread fear surrounding cholesterol is the meteoric increase of prescriptions for a type of cholesterol-lowering medication called statins. If you're still a few decades away from being prescribed one, chances are you'll find a bottle in your parents' medicine cabinet. It's clear what they are because their chemical names all end in statin. An estimated 20 million Americans take statins, making them the most widely prescribed class of drug in the world. The most commonly sold variant is rosuvastatin, which regularly makes it to number one on the list of top-selling drugs in the United States. This is a big business, netting pharmaceutical companies $35 billion in sales in 2010. Long before my mom began to show signs of cognitive decline, she was put on one of these drugs when it was determined by one of her physicians that her elevated cholesterol needed to be treated. Even though she's never had a heart attack or stroke, when she told me over the phone that she'd began taking the drug, I was in Los Angeles at the time, I assumed that it was safe and par for the course of getting older. Plus, a doctor prescribed it. How could it be anything but safe? The problem is, statins are not like seatbelts. They often have unintended side effects, or what my friend psychiatrist Kelly Brogan calls simply effects. As you've learned, cholesterol is important for many things, including immunity, hormone synthesis, and healthy brain function. Evidence suggests that while statins do reduce total LDL, they do little to reduce the proportion of small LDL, which is actually the most risk-promoting, easily oxidized variant of LDL. This is because statins decrease the amount of LDL created by the liver, but don't solve the underlying LDL recycling problem described earlier. In fact, some studies have shown that statins can actually increase the proportion of small, dense LDL. Many physicians, however, do not distinguish between LDL patterns before taking out the prescription pad. To learn the dominant particle size along with the number of LDL particles in your blood, ask your doctor to run an NMR lipid profile. Dr. Yun Kyun Shin, whom I mentioned earlier, is among the scientists to validate the notion that cholesterol-lowering drugs can also lower the brain's production of cholesterol. If you try to lower the cholesterol by taking medicine that is attacking the machinery of cholesterol synthesis in the liver, that medicine goes to the brain too. And then it reduces the synthesis of cholesterol, which is necessary in the brain, he said in an Iowa State University release. Because the brain is made largely of fat, statins with a higher affinity for fat are more easily able to penetrate the brain. Atorvastatin, lovastatin, and simvastatin are lipophilic, or fat-loving, and can cross the blood-brain barrier more easily. Countless reports have been made of these lipophilic variants inducing cognitive side effects, mimicking dementia in extreme cases. The drug that my mom was on at the onset of her cognitive symptoms was lovastatin. On the other hand, pravastatin, rosuvastatin, and fluvastatin are more hydrophilic or water-loving variants and may be somewhat safer options. Statins also lower levels of coenzyme Q10 or CoQ10, a nutrient important for brain metabolism. As you're going to learn in the next chapter, brain metabolism is vitally important, and decreased metabolism has been linked as the earliest measurable feature in preclinical Alzheimer's disease. CoQ10 is also a fat-soluble antioxidant and helps to keep oxidative stress in check. Lowering it with statins could be bad news for the oxygen and polyunsaturated fat-rich brain. Doctor's note: why we're wary of statins. The paradigm under which statins were originally studied and for which the strongest data in support of their use exists was secondary prevention, preventing a heart attack after you've already had one. The indication for their use was expanded to primary prevention, preventing a cardiovascular event in someone who's never had one, through drug company-funded studies, essentially labeling millions of Americans who had never had a heart problem as now having the disease of hypercholesterolemia, or high cholesterol. But that's good, right? We're saving lives. The key concept here, however, is that most of those people put on a statin for high cholesterol would never have had a heart attack in the first place. I'll say that again. The largest proportion of people who take statins are healthy individuals. The statin is helping someone, but for each person it helps, we as physicians have to give it to potentially hundreds of perfectly healthy people with the accompanying side effects and no health benefit whatsoever. One way we quantify the overall effectiveness of a drug is the NNT, or number needed to treat. To illustrate, let's look at car seatbelts. If they are worn as a preventative tactic with widespread use, their efficacy is substantial, and the risk of serious side effects is close to zero. Many people have to wear seatbelts in order to save one life. A massive NNT. But this is not much of a problem, as wearing a seatbelt confers no side effects. This is not the case for statins, which regularly cause muscle pain, memory problems, and metabolic dysfunction, greatly increasing the risk of diabetes and even Parkinsonism in otherwise healthy people. So what's the NNT for statins in at-risk adults with no known cardiac disease? Studies range from 100 to 150 to prevent one cardiac event, heart attack or stroke, with no effect on death rate. In other words, 99 of 100 subjects would have no benefit from the statin. If this were something with minimal cost and zero side effects, like a seatbelt, we might be able to justify giving those 99 people this extra medication. But this is where the inverse of NNT comes in, NNH, or number needed to harm. For statins, the NNH to develop muscle damage, or myopathy, is 9, or about 1 in 10 patients, and the NNH for diabetes is 250. There is no right or wrong answer to, should I be on a statin? That said, you and your physician should be able to have this informed conversation and come to a decision about what you put into your body and why. Unfortunately, most physicians are too pressed for time in the current insurance climate to have such a nuanced conversation with every patient, which means they're forced to take shortcuts and generally end up over-treating or using cookie-cutter guidelines. As a primary care physician, I prescribe statins very selectively, generally only in the case of secondary prevention, i.e. after a cardiovascular event, and sometimes not even then. I always partner with my patients to come up with a global risk reduction plan, including many of the recommendations in this book, of which diet and exercise are the cornerstones. Another means by which statins can affect the brain, both directly and indirectly, is by nearly doubling your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Published in 2015, a very large long-term study involving 3,982 statin users and 21,988 non-users, all with the same risk factors for diabetes, found that though all subjects began the study in normal metabolic health, the statin group had twice the rate of diabetes after 10 years, and more ended up overweight. Remember, having type 2 diabetes increases your risk for Alzheimer's disease 2 to 4-fold, along with any number of other chronic diseases, including heart disease. At this point, you may be wondering, if statins are so widely prescribed, are they helping anybody aside from Big Pharma's bottom line? For patients who already have cardiovascular disease, statins provide an anti-inflammatory effect, independent of their effect on cholesterol. As I've mentioned, inflammation is a major driver of not only cardiovascular disease, but diseases of the brain as well. And for this reason, statins may confer some smidgen of benefit. But why put yourself through all of the side effects I've just mentioned when inflammation can be modulated by diet and lifestyle? What I hope you take away from this section, even if you're not currently on a statin drug, is a sense of how intricately connected the systems of the body are. Though your primary care doctor may prescribe a statin based on a report of high cholesterol and send you on your way, drugs do not work in isolation. Nor, as you've learned, do compounds manufactured by our own bodies. So, reduce carbohydrate and polyunsaturated fat consumption, and eat all the coconut and omelets you want, while you let your cholesterol continue to safely fulfill its many important roles in your body. Up next, how to tap into the universe's most advanced hybrid fueling technology, and I'm not talking about a car. Field notes. Cholesterol is critical to an optimally functioning brain and body, but its mode of transportation, the LDL particle, is highly vulnerable to the insults of the Western diet and lifestyle. Avoid sugar, refined carbohydrates, and potential gut-busting insults like chronic stress and a fiber-deficient diet, which take a good thing, your healthy LDL particles, and make it bad. Cholesterol, the passenger on the LDL particle, is often simply an innocent bystander. Polyunsaturated oils are easily oxidized and torch the inside of your blood vessels. LDL damage is a product of poor recycling. Easing the processing load on the liver will help it more effectively recycle LDL, preventing it from forming small, dense particles that can develop into plaque in your arteries. Statins are a brain drain. Have a conversation with your doctor before you start them or discontinue them for primary prevention, that is, preventing a heart problem if you've never had one. Genius food number 5, eggs. Concerns about the dangerous cholesterol content in egg yolks have been debunked. Recent large long-term studies have elucidated that even a high degree of egg consumption does not increase risk for cardiovascular disease or Alzheimer's disease. In fact, eggs actually boost cognitive function and markers for cardiovascular health. One study performed in men and women with metabolic syndrome found that with a reduced carbohydrate diet, 3 whole eggs per day reduced insulin resistance, raised HDL, and increased the size of LDL particles to a much greater degree than the equivalent supplementation with egg whites. In an embryo, the nervous system, which includes the brain, is among the very first systems to develop. Therefore, an egg yolk is perfectly designed by nature to contain everything needed to grow a healthy, optimally performing brain. This helps make eggs, and especially the yolks, one of the most nutritious foods you can consume. They contain a little bit of nearly every vitamin and mineral required by the human body, including vitamin A, vitamin B12, vitamin E, selenium, zinc, and others. They also provide an abundant source of choline, which is important for both healthy, flexible cell membranes and a learning and memory neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And egg yolks contain lutein and zeaxanthin, 2 carotenoids shown to protect the brain and improve neural processing speed. In one Tufts University study, eating just 1.3 egg yolks per day for 4.5 weeks increased blood levels of zeaxanthin by 114 to 142% and lutein by 28 to 50%. Wow! How to use. Enjoy liberal consumption of whole eggs. Scramble them, poach them, fry them in butter or coconut oil, or soft boil them. Since egg yolks contain many valuable fats and cholesterol that are vulnerable to oxidation, I recommend keeping the yolk runny or more custard-like as opposed to cooking it through, hard-boiled for example. For scrambles and omelets, this means using low heat and keeping the eggs creamy or soft as opposed to dry and hard. How to buy. With so many egg varieties available, it can be confusing to know which ones to buy, and it will often depend on your food budget. Here's a simple metric to help guide your choice. Pasture-raised is better than omega-3 enriched, which is better than free-range, which is better than conventional. Regardless of variety, eggs are always a low-carb, inexpensive, and highly nutritious choice, even conventional eggs, if that's all your budget allows. They are perfect for breakfast, but can be great with any meal, even dinner. And, most important, eat the yolks, folks. Chapter 6. Fueling Your Brain. We've already covered how diet can help you attain the most receptive possible membranes for your 86 billion brain cells. We've discussed how to deliver healthy blood and nutrients to those cells, as well as why we should keep insulin signaling well-regulated and blood sugar low. But what we have yet to discuss are the engines of those cells, the organelles responsible for keeping the lights on, mitochondria. Right at this very moment, we are amid a global energy crisis. It's not something you'll read about in the newspaper. It's not the beneficiary of expensive fundraisers and galas or scientific grants. And it isn't the subject of a dozen Netflix documentaries with A-list actors as executive producers. It may, however, be responsible for mental fatigue, insatiable hunger, brain fog, forgetfulness, and widespread cognitive decay. Your brain requires a tremendous amount of fuel to function properly. Despite its relatively tiny mass, 2 to 3% of your body's total volume, it accounts for 20 to 25% of your resting metabolic rate. This means that one quarter of the oxygen you breathe and the food you eat is being used to create energy to fuel your brain's many processes. Whether studying for a test, preparing for a speech, or swiping through your favorite dating app, your brain is burning through fuel at the same rate as the leg muscles during a marathon race. Our energy crisis is not from a shortage of fuel, however. Our brains, if anything, are overfueled. For the first time in history, there are more overweight than underweight humans walking the earth. So what then accounts for the cognitive malaise? Punished at the pump. By the middle of the 20th century, petroleum-based gasoline became the fuel used by the vast majority of cars on the road. It is only now, decades later, that we realize our gasoline addiction has many long-term side effects and unintended consequences not appreciated until potentially irreversible havoc has been wrought on the environment and our health. Glucose, one of the brain's primary forms of fuel, is in many ways like gasoline, and it enters the blood by way of the carbohydrates we consume. A warm sourdough roll? Glucose. A medium baked potato? Glucose. A wedge of highly cultivated sweet pineapple? Glucose. And fructose. When you consume it frequently, glucose provides the main source of energy for the brain. From this sugar, our mitochondria generate energy at the cellular level through a form of complex combustion involving oxygen. This process is called aerobic metabolism, and life as we know it would be impossible without it. But as with gasoline, metabolism comes at a cost. Exhaust. One of the byproducts of glucose metabolism is the creation of compounds called reactive oxygen species, or free radicals. These damaged zombie molecules are the same as those described in Chapter 2, and their presence is a normal and unavoidable aspect of living. Right now, as you read this, mitochondria throughout your body and brain are converting glucose and oxygen to energy and leaving behind these waste products as a result. Free radicals aren't all bad. During exercise, their concentration is momentarily increased and they become powerful signaling mechanisms, coaxing the body to adapt and detoxify in powerful ways. I'll cover this in greater detail in Chapter 10. Under ideal circumstances, we have the ability to clean up these compounds. But when excessive free radical production is sustained, it can outrun our body's ability to effectively mop things up, thereby kicking off a cascade of damaging processes that drive aging and its associated conditions. Epilepsy, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, MS, autism, and even depression are all conditions in which oxidative stress runs rampant in the brain, propagating the disease process. This is why an alternate fuel source to glucose, the biological equivalent of a fossil fuel, might be of value, one that burns cleaner and more efficiently and can be sustained for a longer period of time. As it happens, we don't have to look very far. Scientists have known since the mid-60s of a powerful fuel source hidden in each and every one of us, discovered upon observation of an ancient practice. Opening up the ketone fire hose. Nearly every major religion has their version of a fasting protocol, from the Islamic month of Ramadan to the Jewish Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. In the book of Acts from the Christian New Testament, it is said that believers would fast before making important decisions. What all of these ancient traditions have in common is that they recognize the psychological and physiological effects of fasting long before they understood the science behind it. After a person has finished digesting the last calorie from a meal, the first source of backup fuel that the brain will tap is from the liver. The liver plays hundreds of incredibly important roles in the body. You can consider it a multipurpose high-tech manufacturing plant capable of packing, shipping, storing, and disposing of an infinite array of important chemicals and fuels. In the previous chapter, you learned about the liver's job of recycling cholesterol carriers like LDL. But another important role is its ability to provide a small buffer of stored sugar called glycogen. When blood glucose levels begin to drop, the liver releases glucose into the blood. The liver's storage capacity is fairly limited, holding only about 100 grams of glycogen. That means this backup source of sugar is short-lived, lasting only about 12 hours, give or take, depending on activity levels. After the liver runs out of stored sugar, your brain becomes the man-eating Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors, demanding to be fed. This is what most people feel when they experience the combination of being hungry and angry, known affectionately as being hangry. This sensation is owed in part to a brain that has become the equivalent of a man-eating alien from outer space. Ever the obedient servant and the Seymour in our Shop of Horrors analogy, the liver triggers a process called gluconeogenesis, which translates to new sugar creation. As nature's ultimate recycling plant, the liver kills two birds with one stone. When the body runs out of sugar, the liver will take worn-out, dysfunctional proteins from around the body, disassemble them into their constituent amino acids, and burn them off. Chopped liver, in reality, your liver is doing the chopping, dicing up proteins and turning them into sugar. Brain fed, body cleaned. This ability of our bodies to clean house as a means of cellular rejuvenation is called autophagy and is currently an exciting area of focus for longevity researchers. When you experience regular periods of feeding and fasting, autophagy occurs on a daily basis. Today, unfortunately, we seldom allow it to, with the lever jammed permanently in feeding mode. But even though it is a desirable process, without a system of biological checks and balances, it could get out of hand quickly. Your skeletal muscle, like your biceps or quads or, heaven forbid, your glutes, could become a target for gluconeogenesis, seeing as how they are essentially big protein banks. Breaking down muscle wouldn't exactly be desirable for a hungry hunter-gatherer. During periods of famine, this also wouldn't buy you very much time. To support the brain's metabolic requirements with protein alone would lead to death in about 10 miserable days. To prevent this, a hormone called growth hormone becomes sharply elevated when the body is fasting. Growth hormone serves many roles, but its main function in adults is to preserve lean mass in a fasted state. That is, to stop the breakdown of muscle protein for glucose. After just 24 hours of fasting, growth hormone can shoot up as high as 2,000%, more on this in Chapter 9, sending our bodies a signal to suspend muscle breakdown and rev up the fat-burning machinery instead. Fat, on the other hand, is there to be burned. It's the body's firewood, containing more than 3,000 backup calories of brain fuel in just a single pound. An average weight person walks around with tens of thousands of backup calories, while an obese person might carry hundreds of thousands. Unlike with sugar, the number of calories we can store as fat is virtually limitless. When adipose tissue, the fat that sits underneath our skin and around our waists, gets broken down during times of starvation, fatty acids are released into the bloodstream to be converted by the liver into a fuel called ketone bodies, or simply ketones. Ketones are easily taken up by the cells of the brain and can supply up to 60% of the brain's energy requirements. In a paper published in 2004, pioneering ketone researcher Richard Veach wrote, "Ketone bodies deserve the designation of a superfuel," and you're about to learn why. The solution to pollution? Unlike glucose, ketones are considered a clean burning fuel source because they create more energy per unit of oxygen in fewer metabolic steps, thereby generating fewer zombie molecules, free radicals, in their conversion to energy. They have also been shown to dramatically increase the availability of natural antioxidants like glutathione, the body's most potent neutralizer of free radicals, making ketone utilization an anti-aging two-for-one deal. But the longevity-promoting virtues of ketones don't end there. Their presence in the brain has been shown to ignite gene pathways that boost levels of BDNF, the growth hormone that can facilitate healthy mood, learning, and plasticity, further protecting our neurons from the wear and tear of simply living. As I mentioned in the previous chapter, they also positively affect the brain's blood supply, increasing blood flow by as much as 39%. Baby fat isn't just cute, it's a battery. Have you seen a baby lately? I'm talking about a newborn, fresh out of the womb. They're fat. And cute, but mostly fat. Packed with stored energy prior to birth in the third trimester, the fatness of human babies is unprecedented in the mammal world. While the newborns of most mammal species average 2-3% of birth weight as body fat, humans are born with a body fat percentage of nearly 15, surpassing the fatness of even newborn seals. Why is this so? Because humans are born half-baked. When a healthy human baby emerges from the womb, she is born physically helpless and with an underdeveloped brain. Unlike most animals at birth, a newborn human is not equipped with a full catalog of instincts pre-installed. It is estimated that if a human were to be born at a similar stage of cognitive development to a newborn chimp, gestation would be at least double the length. That doesn't sound fun. Am I right, ladies? By being born prematurely, human brains complete their development not in the womb, but in the real world, with open eyes and open ears. This is probably why we're so social and smart. And it's during this period of rapid brain growth, what some refer to as the fourth trimester, that our fat serves as an important ketone reservoir for the brain, which can account for nearly 90% of the newborn's metabolism. Now you know, baby fat isn't just there for pinching. It's there for the brain. In the context of a normal Western diet that's rich in carbohydrates, significant ketone production is inhibited the vast majority of the time. This is because foods that are high in carbohydrates elicit an insulin response from the pancreas, and ketosis is brought to a grinding halt whenever insulin is elevated. Suppression of insulin, on the other hand, either by fasting or by eating a diet very low in carbohydrates, drives ketogenesis. Let's explore these two routes to ketone creation. Intermittent fasting. Today, humans spend most of their time feeding, with little time sped in a fasted state. We typically eat from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep. This, however, was not the case for most of human history. Long before religion or diet books made calorie deprivation a carefully considered choice, our pre-agricultural ancestors regularly experienced fasting as a consequence of an unpredictable food supply. Their brains, and those we inherited, were forged in this uncertainty, and are elegantly adapted to oscillate between the fed and fasted states as a result. By periodically restricting our food intake, we force physiological adaptation and the production of ketones. There are many different fasting protocols that one may choose to employ. By ensuring a 16-hour window has passed since your last ingested calorie, you are practicing the common 16-to-8 method of fasting, which entails 16 hours of fasting and 8 hours of allowed feeding. This can be done daily and confers many of the benefits of fasting, namely reducing insulin and promoting the breakdown of stored fats. We usually recommend women start with 12 to 14 hours rather than 16. Women's hormone systems may be more sensitive to signals of food scarcity. For example, extended fasts may negatively affect fertility. One way to achieve a fast of 12 to 16 hours may be simply skipping breakfast, a non-essential meal despite what cereal companies will tell you. Extending the fast that you endure every night while sleeping also makes use of the body's waking hormone, cortisol, which peaks 30 to 45 minutes after waking. This hormone helps to mobilize fatty acids, glucose, and protein from storage for use as fuel, which may provide a small added bonus. More on this in Chapter 9, over skipping dinner. Skipping breakfast also works because it's often easier to start eating later than it is to stop eating earlier, since dinner tends to be our most social meal. But if you're unable to skip breakfast, eating dinner earlier is a worthy alternative, as shown in a recent study from Louisiana State University. In this trial, overweight subjects consumed all of their calories between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., the average feeding time for most folks. But when the researchers told the subjects to skip dinner and stop eating at 2 p.m., the burning of fat, i.e. ketones, as opposed to glucose, was increased. Subjects also showed improved metabolic flexibility, which is the body's ability to switch between burning carbs and fats. This means that having a light dinner, eating it earlier in the evening, or skipping it entirely once or twice a week may help stoke the fat-burning flames. Eating late can also disrupt the body's natural inclination to wind down at night. Other fasting protocols being studied include alternate day fasting, which, like the 16-8 method, is another example of time-restricted feeding, and periodic very low-calorie diets. The idea behind the latter is that the body reacts to an energy deficit by releasing stored calories regardless of whether carbohydrates are consumed. This so-called fasting mimicking diet, studied by researcher Walter Longo, may confer significant benefits, including decreased risk factors and biomarkers for aging, diabetes, cancer, and neurodegenerative and cardiovascular disease. From the available options, which style of fasting should you choose? Henry David Thoreau famously observed that life is frittered away by detail. When it comes to picking and sticking to a protocol, most people, male or female, will benefit from not eating for an hour or two or more after waking and not eating for 2 to 3 hours before bed. This will make use of the body's natural rhythms to optimize ketone creation, among other positive things. Creatine, a muscle and brain builder. In a sea of overhyped marketing claims that support a $1 billion per year supplement industry, creatine holds court as one of the few markedly effective tools with both a strong evidence record and safety profile. It's a natural substance produced in the body and found in red meat and fish. 1 pound raw beef contains 2.5 grams of creatine, and supplementing with it leads to substantially increased muscle performance. Adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, is the energy currency of cells, used during muscle contraction. Once ATP gets used by a cell during intense exercise, creatine acts like an energy reserve, recycling it to create new ATP. No additional glucose or oxygen is needed, and ATP output remains constant. Consuming additional creatine leads to increased cellular energy stores in muscle, which allows for increased energy replenishment. But creatine isn't just for powering through heavy gym workouts, it's a necessity in the brain, acting as a high-energy buffer to help rapidly recycle ATP. While ATP use holds stable during mental exertion, creatine levels drop in support of the energetic needs of the brain, and higher levels of brain creatine are correlated with better memory performance. Because they don't eat red meat or fish, vegetarians and vegans lack the main sources of dietary creatine, and as a result, they have lower levels of it in their blood than omnivores. Though the body does create its own creatine, doing so is a stress on the system, one that can raise levels of an amino acid called homocysteine, which is a risk marker for heart disease and Alzheimer's. When vegetarians were given supplemental creatine, 20 grams per day for 5 days, their cognitive function improved. This was replicated in another study where supplementation of only 5 grams of creatine per day for 6 weeks enhanced working memory and processing speed and reduced mental fatigue in vegetarians. According to the researchers, these findings underlined the dynamic and significant role of brain energy capacity in influencing brain performance. In these studies, young, healthy omnivores didn't experience a significant cognitive boost, but vegetarians did. Why? The brain may have a saturation point beyond which supplementing with additional creatine is futile, and by simply eating meat, a person reaches this point. On the other hand, for those who do not consume much red meat or fish, there may be room to top off the brain supply to the benefit of one's cognitive function. But low meat eaters aren't the only group who may benefit. The body's ability to produce creatine and supply it to the brain may diminish with age. One surprising study in elderly omnivores found that creatine supplementation did boost cognitive function. And finally, carriers of the Alzheimer's risk gene, the APOE4 allele, have lower levels of brain creatine. They, and those who are at risk of or are already experiencing cognitive symptoms, may benefit from the neuroprotective and energy-sustaining aspects of creatine. Be sure to double-check with your physician before taking creatine supplements, especially if you have kidney problems. The ketogenic diet. The classical ketogenic diet is the gold standard means of dramatically increasing ketone production without having to engage in time-restricted feeding or dropping calories. The diet focuses on minimizing insulin secretion with an extremely restricted carbohydrate intake, deriving 60 to 80% of calories from fat, 15 to 35% from protein, and 5% from carbohydrate. For someone on a ketogenic diet, concentrated sources of carbohydrates, whether from sweet fruit, grains, or starchy vegetables like potatoes, are prohibited. Protein on a ketogenic diet. Contrary to popular belief, ketogenic diets are not meant to be high in protein. This is because excess protein, beyond what is required to maintain your muscle, can be transformed into glucose in the body, a process called gluconeogenesis. Dietary protein is also insulin-stimulating, albeit to a much smaller degree than carbohydrates. Insulin helps to shuttle amino acids from the protein into skeletal muscle tissue to aid in repair. This is helpful in the context of resistance training, for example, where it promotes muscle protein synthesis. The ketogenic diet has been in clinical use for over 80 years as a powerful treatment for epilepsy, where it can dramatically reduce seizure incidence and calm inflammation in the brain. It's been so effective and its safety record so robust that it's currently being evaluated as a therapeutic option for numerous other neurological diseases. Migraines, depression, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and even amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, are all conditions that have been associated with excessive brain inflammation. Any of these conditions may theoretically benefit from ketones, not only for treatment, but in prevention. The ketogenic diet has been found to improve memory function in patients with mild cognitive impairment, considered pre-dementia, and even early Alzheimer's disease. Ketogenic diets are also being studied as a potential treatment for certain cancers. The cells of these cancers thrive in high insulin environments and don't have the hybrid technology of the rest of the body, which means they are unable to survive off of ketone bodies. Whether this plays out long term remains to be seen, as cancer cells are notorious for circumventing, mutating, and adapting to even the most toxic environments. At the end of the day, however, insulin and closely related insulin-like peptides called IGF-1 and IGF-2 are powerful growth factors for any cells, healthy or cancerous, that contain receptors for them. Whether used to treat neurological problems, to serve as a metabolic reset for those with type 2 diabetes, a ketogenic diet will, on average, half the amount of circulating insulin and improve glucose control after just one day, or for those looking to shed a lot of fat fast, ketogenic diets hold a lot of promise. The Genius Plan. The Genius Plan, fully outlined in Chapter 11, is no doubt a variant of the ketogenic diet. It combines intermittent fasting with low-carbohydrate eating to increase ketone availability to the brain. However, it differs from the ketogenic diet described in neurological literature in a few key ways. For one, standard ketogenic diets are not designed to consider the burgeoning science of the microbiome, which we cover in the following chapter. The microbiome rewards us when we consume an ample and diverse array of fibrous vegetables, vegetables that contain carbohydrates, even if just a few. And thus, the Genius Plan includes these foods. These vegetables also contain important vitamins and minerals that we don't want to skimp on. Another key difference is in the types of fat. The sheer quantity of fat that must be consumed in the textbook versions of the ketogenic diet may make it substantially more difficult to make important brain-building considerations, like ensuring proper omega-3 to omega-6 ratio. The medical ketogenic diet makes no such stipulations and classically relies on foods like heavy cream and cheese to make up the bulk of calories. While the Genius Plan takes the omega-3 and omega-6 ratio into account and adjusts accordingly. Perhaps most important, exercise is a major aspect of any optimal brain protocol, and the one you're listening to now is no different. Those in chronic ketosis from long-term ketogenic diets can find their workout performance begin to suffer, particularly when looking to put on muscle or gain strength with high-intensity exercise. Preserving muscle is essential as we age, and is in fact directly correlated with higher brain power. The occasional post-workout high-carbohydrate meal, while not typically used for a ketogenic diet, is allowed on the Genius Plan, only once metabolic flexibility is regained, to ensure that training capacity, metabolism, hormones, and lipids stay in their optimal range. I'll provide specific details on how to approach these meals in Chapter 11. Post-workout carbs, a performance-enhancing drug? Carbs are not bad, they're just woefully misused today. If you choose to consume them, it's best to time them so that the anabolic stimulus serves a functional purpose in the body, to enhance your performance, not weigh it down. A best-case scenario? Refilling muscle tissue with stored sugar after a bout of vigorous exercise. Resistance training is one of the best-known means of improving overall insulin sensitivity. But the post-workout period in general has the additional benefit of turning muscles into a sponge for sugar in the blood. This is owed to the GLUT4 receptor. A channel for glucose, these receptors hide under the surface of muscle cell membranes until they start contracting, at which time they pop up to the surface. Remember the neurotransmitter receptors from Chapter 2 and how they bob up to the surface? This is exactly the same economical mechanism, elegantly reappropriated for muscles. Your DNA and genome are like an erector set with modular and swappable parts that can have completely different functions using the same building blocks. Once present on the cell surface, a GLUT4 receptor will turn into a spigot that allows sugar to flow into the cell like water through an open dam. This means that for the same given amount of carbs, less insulin is needed to safely partition and dispose of it if consumed post-workout. What does this mean for you? Carbs are less likely to promote fat storage, and you will sooner bounce back into a fat-burning state. Essentially, the safest time to consume simple or concentrated complex carbs is after you've been working out. Earn your carbs. Returning to our factory settings. It can be daunting to begin a lower carbohydrate diet, to say nothing of intermittent fasting. Believe me, I know. When I was a kid, my mom would try every year in vain to get me to fast for one day in observance of the Jewish holiday Yom Kippur, which I thought was pointless masochism. I would rather have taken a trip to my orthodontist, Dr. Moskowitz, to get my braces tightened than ever skip a meal. Today, however, I can easily fast for hours. Dropping carbs? Eat some salt. One very frequently overlooked factor that sometimes makes people feel crummy when beginning a low-carb diet is that lowering insulin, a good thing, can deplete the body of sodium. Among its myriad of jobs, sodium helps shuttle vitamin C into the brain, where it is used to create neurotransmitters that can affect your mood and memory. Sodium is also key to maintaining exercise performance as you drop the carbs. According to cardiovascular research scientist and sodium expert James D. Nicolantonio, during the first week of carbohydrate restriction, you may require up to an additional 2 grams of sodium, about a teaspoon of salt per day to feel optimal, which can be reduced to 1 gram after the first week. Remember, individual experimentation is key. You can watch a 30-minute long interview I did with James at maxl.ug/JamesDinnickInterview to learn more about this fascinating topic. But my doctor told me to be on a low-sodium diet for blood pressure. Insulin and sugar may affect blood pressure more than salt. They stimulate the body's fight-or-flight cascade, which can promote high blood pressure and cause the body to hold on to more sodium anyway. When we chronically deny our brains any respite from glucose, this creates addiction, which explains why the sudden removal of carbohydrates can lead to headaches and fatigue. This is what I experienced as a pizza and Pop-Tart eating preteen. However, when you combine periodic low-carb phases with regular fasting, you set the physiological stage to return your metabolism to its factory setting. By reducing insulin and allowing the ketone fire hose to be turned on, you regain metabolic flexibility, thereby training your metabolism to work for you, not the other way around. This is the holy grail of metabolic health. The following 7 steps to becoming metabolically flexible all involve adapting your brain to use ketones from fat for fuel, and they mimic the cascade set forth by fasting. We theorize that the hunger and headaches that may occur during this 3 to 7 day period correspond with the brain's upregulating of enzymes required to process ketones as fuel. These times are approximations assuming a non-keto adapted state. 1. Depletion of last consumed carbohydrate, 4 to 12 hours. 2. Depletion of the body's stored carbohydrate. Recall that the liver can store about 100 grams of carbohydrate in the form of glycogen, give or take depending on body size, 12 to 18 hours. 3. Decrease in amino acid breakdown to preserve muscle, 20 to 36 hours. 4. Breakdown of amino acids for gluconeogenesis, 24 to 72 hours. 5. Increase in ketone production and utilization, 48 to 72 plus hours. 6. Upregulating of ketone-burning enzymes in the brain. This takes up to a week, but can be shortened by emptying carb stores faster with high-intensity exercise, eating an overall lower carbohydrate diet, or integrating medium-chain triglycerides, discussed momentarily, 1 to 7 days. 7. Enter a state of metabolic flexibility. Here, the occasional carb meal can be consumed without interrupting the fat-adapted state, especially when consumed during or after a workout. The key to experiencing true freedom from food lies in cutting off our dependency on glucose and reestablishing the kind of metabolic flexibility our ancestors knew well. After a few days on a low-carb diet, the feeling of hunger and craving for more carb-rich foods will begin to subside and ultimately fade away. Here are some signs that your body's fat pipeline is up and running. You can go several hours without eating and not want to kill anybody. You do not crave starchy or sugary snacks in between meals. Your mind is sharp and clear and your mood and energy levels are stable. And moderate exercise doesn't induce ravenous hunger or fatigue. Doctor's note, females and super low carb diets. While we generally advocate a lower carb diet than the standard American fare, it should be noted that there are substantial genetic and gender differences in carbohydrate tolerance. In particular, females on ultra-low-carb ketogenic diets can experience stalled weight loss, mood issues, and disruption of their menstrual cycles. The optimal amount of carbohydrate on a daily or weekly basis should generally vary based on level of physical activity and can range anywhere from 30 to 150 grams per day. We will talk more about carb amounts and timing in Chapter 11. Ketones, a life raft for the aging brain? Now that you know how to enter a state of ketosis, you should be aware that the benefits of allowing the brain to burn ketones instead of glucose don't end at the fact that they are a cleaner burning fuel source. One of the major benefits of supplying ketones to the brain that I have yet to mention is that certain brains may actually work better when given the chance to run on ketones. These brains may be unable to process glucose effectively, but are given little to no alternative thanks to our keto-deficient diets, a term coined by ketone researcher Sam Henderson. A prime example may be carriers of the most well-defined Alzheimer's risk gene, the APOE4 allele. Carriers of either one or two copies of this gene, which make up more than a quarter of the population, have been demonstrated to exhibit low glucose metabolism in the brain. This occurs seemingly across the age spectrum, starting as early as the 20s and 30s, which is well before the age at which memory-related symptoms typically emerge. Carriers of the APOE4 allele have either a 2 or 12-fold increased risk of developing the disease, depending on whether they've inherited one or two copies. Despite the increased risk, however, many APOE4 carriers never go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. Weirder still, a significant number of patients with Alzheimer's disease do not carry this gene variant at all. And yet, non-carriers who develop Alzheimer's disease ultimately display the same reduced glucose metabolism in their brains as APOE4 carriers, implicating impaired brain glucose metabolism as a possible causative factor in the disease. This paradox begs the question, is the worrying relationship between APOE4 and Alzheimer's disease yet another symptom of the eating pattern we've been coerced to adopt? The APOE4 gene is considered the ancestral gene, having been in the human gene pool longer than other variants. In populations with earlier exposure to agriculture, i.e. access to grains and starches, the frequency of the gene